Cannabis Business Minds, we train and mentor professionals, entrepreneurs, and aspiring entrepreneurs on how to confidently find their place in the legal cannabis and hemp industries. Come on and join us at CannabisBusinessMinds.com.
So I was like, and I was like, I need to hear this guy's story. The fact that you've, I'm like, what book, smuggling, you that, but you're like one of the only people that want to talk about like the tax in New York because nobody's talking about this. So I was like, oh, this is interesting. So I'm excited to get you on.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm grateful. So I'll start wherever you want. I don't even have much background on you. Are you a CPA?
I'm a CPA. It's so interesting to ask that question. Like, tell me about yourself, right? I think it's always about the audience of who you're talking to. But from a cannabis perspective, from a life perspective, I'm a CPA. I'm an expat. I'm living in Portugal. I had been working in the industry since 2015. I wrote a book about cannabis taxes. I started this podcast in 2016 when I started getting interested in it from like the economic business perspective, because it was funny when you filled out your form, you're like, I was like, why are you part of the industry? And you're like, because it helps me, weed helps me with pain. And so my long life with cannabis or weed, it started a long time ago before I got in the industry. But from an industry perspective, 2015, started helping businesses in Los Angeles. That's where I was at that time, really getting into the not the illicit market anymore, right? Getting from illicit to regulated industry. So that's my kind of cannabis stint a bit. I did a lot of stuff with women and women's empowerment. And then when I moved to Europe and right before the pandemic, I kind of switched gears towards personal finance and really building other things. And so cannabis, I'm not really involved in the industry as much. And I've got this podcast and I've got a lot of listeners that want to know what's going on in cannabis. And I'm not as involved as I was. And it's hard to ask the right questions or show up at the right time because I'm in Portugal. So I've been looking for collaborators who want to like take over the podcast for a few episodes, tell their stories and share their insight, especially like what's going on in New York and Massachusetts, New Jersey, and that whole kind of New England area. Like I'm a West Coaster. Like I wouldn't even have dabbled into it as much as somebody probably like yourself can. So I'm excited. I'm excited to chat with you. I'm excited to see where this goes. Even in the last week, I've talked to a lot of great people in your neck of the woods that are going to be collaborators on the podcast. So it's exciting because you all have something very different to share than I do.
I'm happy. Well, thank you for having me on, and I'm open to any questions or wherever you want to take this.
Yeah. Well, I think the first one is like, what is your cannabis story?
Oh, well, I was probably safe to say I was one of the largest smugglers of cannabis on the East Coast in the early 2000s, starting in the late 90s into the early 2000s. I smuggled well over $300 million worth of cannabis between New York and New Orleans and every single state. I had warehouses, drivers, 14 cell phones, PGP encrypted Blackberries with our own servers that couldn't be penetrated by the government. And I did it all without a gun. So there's a lot of players that get to that level, but usually they have to take out witnesses or whatever. I was a level 9 in the underworld. Level 10 is when you take out the witnesses. I didn't do that. So there's no violence. It was just basically I was a young kid that liked to smoke weed, and I started selling it just to make enough money to eat and sleep, right? And then it expanded. I was a good businessman. I kept my word, and there was no violence at all. White collar. I worked with every color of person you can imagine. But I learned a lot about the cannabis business doing that. And I watched, even back then when I shouldn't have said that. No witnesses. I could have put a vibe. I totally see that. I didn't mean to say it like that.
No, but it's the truth.
It's the truth. Like I could have kept going and expanded my empire if I wanted to do certain things, right? Like I never touched a gun. Let's put it that way with the business. So anyway, I became very good at it. And I was eventually after a 12-year run, I got picked up by the feds. So I was in the wrong place, wrong time. They were investigating me. They didn't know my name. They put a GPS on one of my loads and they followed it to one of my properties. Well, I don't know who I was, found me with a couple million in cash, put me in prison. in jail, and then they wanted me to work undercover. I wouldn't do it. And then after a couple of years, my lawyer comes to me. He's like, hey, he comes to my, because I was in a jail cell, not for the full 2 years, but it's like, if you give them the rest of your money, they'll let you go. And so I went out in shackles and I dug up close to $10 million worth of gold bars. I buried in the woods, gave it to the federal government, and then they let me out.
And that let you out. And then what year is that they let you out?
That was 2011. That was before it was legal in any state. The first state it was legal was Colorado, I think around 2012.
Yeah.
So when I was in the game, the margins were a little higher. The prices were higher. Now the market's extremely saturated. You can get weed anywhere for free. So you really have to have a competitive edge in order to stay alive in this industry. And with the taxes and the costs and all this stuff, it's really hard to stay afloat unless you sharpen your pencil and know what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, you just like really breeze through like this like wild story that I'm sure like is in your book, Pressure. I'm curious. If we just like take a step back and like, okay, so you started just selling weed because you wanted to eat. 12 years later, you have this huge empire where you've actually put and been able to like bury $10 million of gold that you can like later on retrieve so you can get out of prison. Like, this is like a wild story. This is Cannabis Business Minds. I always like to talk about business. I do want to talk about your experience in all those aspects, but how did you do it? Like, if you just talked about like business, like how did you build such a big thing in 12 years? Like, what was the way, what did you do?
It was really about putting your customers and suppliers before yourself. I was the boss, but I put everybody ahead of myself. Like, I didn't go to sleep until they were all satisfied and everybody was paid and taken care of and got what they needed, whether it was cannabis or money. Mm-hmm. They got what they needed before I settled down and ate and slept. And I always kept my word. I always under-promised and over-delivered, showed up on time. And the biggest thing was not talking. I never ran my mouth. So whoever I worked with, they only thought I worked with them. They had no clue that I had 10 other people to meet that day. So I was very quiet, and that's what kept me off the feds' radar. Right? I wasn't flashy either. I didn't have nice cars. I rented that stuff when I wasn't around. And I never dealt in my hometown. Because when I was in college, I did get a 4-year degree. When I was in college, the feds did watch me for a couple weeks, but I was a smaller fry back then that they didn't waste the money to go deep. They had a couple kids wear wires on me, and I kind of escaped that because I didn't say anything incriminating, and moved to a small town, create a legitimate business as a cover up. And I only shipped out of state or to New York City. So that at a legal business, that was my cover. But
what was your legal business?
I used to build natural swimming pools and waterfalls without chlorine.
Wow.
Yeah, for like lonely housewives that had a lot of money.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was the desire, though, to like take it so far and so big?
Well, it kept me alive. It's I like the rush. It's really, I like the rush. I like living on the edge. You never at 2 a.m. getting a load that comes over the board. You don't know if it's going to make it. And some of these guys are using night vision with boats, like speeding over a river with in like 2 feet deep of water with like really low profile hulls of boats that can go fast and outrun the cops, like crazy stuff. And to me, that's like you're in a movie straight up.
Yeah.
I was in a movie for 12 years. It went so fast because I was in it. Like the stuff you see in the movies, I was doing every other day.
It seems like it's so easy to kind of just get caught up. It's like that, it's the pace is so fast. You kind of just aren't even thinking, you're just doing and you're just part of it. Why pressure? Because I thought that it seems like you've got this personality where it seems like you definitely like the pressure. But for pressure, when we think about your book and when we think about like, what does that word even mean to you? Because like, you can think about it in many different ways.
Yeah, it's a very relatable word, and I wanted something that somebody could say at a cocktail party and remember it. I wanted two syllables. I wanted something fast, easy, and it's relatable. And here's why I really kept working, too, is I worked out of fear, and a lot of us do that, and we don't even know it. We're operating on a daily basis out of fear of not having enough, fear of lack of money, how am I going to make it? And that was ingrained in me as a child. Like, I remember in a position, like, my most baller moment out of all the money I blew, the millions I spent, was being able to afford 3 chicken chalupas at Taco Bell when I was 17.
Yeah.
That's when I felt really alive. And I got a taste of that because I never could afford that. My mom was like, they're too expensive. We had the coupons. Like, I never had one.
Yeah.
And when I go to when I got the taste of that, and I was high as a kite when I was eating, I was like, this is living.
Yeah.
And I never wanted to go back. So for me, it was operating out of fear. There were times I didn't want to be in the business. I was like, I'm done with this. It's too risky, a lot of close calls.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was just a mindset of fear. And I've overcome a lot of my fear, thankfully, after sitting in a prison cell and just looking inward and looking at myself, being like, you know, you're born naked and you're going to die naked.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because it seems like if you're going so fast, you are just living this like very robust is a funny word, but like this very fulfilling, energetic, like risky life where it's just moving so fast paced. It's like you kind of don't even look at yourself or what's happening inside or that internal reflection. And it's interesting. It's like, you know, you are moving, 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 building, building, building. All of a sudden, your life takes a completely different shift. How is that transition to like literally go to prison, not have anything? Like, what did you learn from that?
I talk about this a little in the book, but the first night in my prison cell was the first night I slept really well in a long time. I slept like 12 hours straight. I had no cell phones ringing. Mm. Nobody needed anything for me. It was peace. But then when I woke up in the morning, I knew it was wartime, right? Like I had to get the lawyers involved and it was go time. But being stripped of everything, well, when I was younger, I identified myself based on what I had rather than who I was, right? I was insecure in a way. Like I have, look at my nice new coat or my nice shoes or whatever, you know, that I can afford. I didn't say that, but that was probably in my mindset, right?
Yeah.
And then you get put in a cell with a little 99-cent jumpsuit from China, you know, and you look in the mirror and you're brushing your teeth and you're like, damn, you know, this is who I really am. Right?
Yeah. Well, I think it lets you kind of wake up. Like, well, this is like the whole thing. I've been just diving into personal finance, and most people's money issues really have nothing to do with money at all. But it's like the emotional stuff, like the fear mindset, the anxiety mindset, the worthiness, like all of that is how we interact or deal with money. And like you said, it's like it's so easy to get caught up in the different ways of spending money to relieve whatever or doing a certain thing because it fulfills something internally. And yeah, I mean, the 99-cent jumpsuit, but that awakening of like, holy shit, like all of the stuff that I had that was so meaningful at that moment or what you had attached me to, like literally shifts overnight. And I couldn't even imagine the personal journey, because it's also one where it's like, you know, at the very beginning of this interview, you said, well, you know, you always have to treat people so well. Like that was your biggest thing about success for your business. You treated everybody first. You put them first. How did that apply to a new environment when you were in prison?
Well, I still put everybody around me first because I sat there and didn't work undercover for them.
Yeah.
If I had put myself first, I could have just worked undercover. I would have been out of there right away.
Mm.
So I still always put everybody first. That's my key to success. I live a simple life and I slow, steady gains. And what was the question again?
Well, it was more just like when you're in that jail, like when you were in prison and the whole success, like I was thinking like you were successful in business because you put everybody first. But then all of a sudden you're in a completely new environment. You don't have anyone. You just have yourself. How do you deal with that? Like, do you put other people first there? Do you protect yourself? Do you just look inward? Like, that's what I was curious about.
Initially it was just I was on the phone trying to talk in code and explain to people what I needed to get done. Like, cause I got put away and I had over $3-4 million on the street, like in all different places. Like my business is still moving. Like I had loads coming that day when I got arrested that I didn't receive. Like there's just so much, there's a lot going on. It just doesn't stop the minute I go in prison. There's things that need to be attended to, but I didn't attend to all that, but let me tell you what happens. And what I said before is you look at yourself and you realize like I have a second chance to live. What I learned in prison, most people don't learn until they're on their deathbed and they look up and they see the white light and they're like, if I only had more time, because when you go away to prison, that's what they take from you is your time.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. Was your original sentence much longer than 2 years?
No, I got a 30-month sentence. It would have been longer if I didn't pay them. I paid them close to $12 million.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
So time and money. those two currencies to yeah. okay. Yeah. Wow. Did you, when you were operating your business, did you have that fear that you'd ever get caught? Because you said, well, I always was under the radar. I made sure that wasn't doing anything flashy. Like, did you ever think to yourself in those 12 years, like what that could be and how that would impact your life?
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I buried the gold. Cause I figured when I get out of jail, I'd have the gold. I just didn't know I'd have to pay yeah. with the gold to get out. I figured you get in trouble with weed, it would just be a slap on the wrist. I didn't really think it through. Plus, when you have over 100 kilos, it's a federal offense versus a state offense, and federal has mandatory minimums.
Yeah.
It's funny we're talking about this now because cannabis is legal, right? It's like everybody just hands around weed for free. But back in the day, it was a different situation.
It was a different story. And also, one of the things I'm really shocked about right now is like how open you are about all of these things. Like, you're not afraid to talk about it, that you're able to say all this stuff without fear. Why is that?
Probably because, you know, I spent a lot of time after I got out of prison working with shamans and stuff, and I went deep with psychedelics, and you know, I'd always done them in party settings, but doing psychedelics in nature helped me reveal my true self. It allowed me to be myself without fear of judgment, right? So I don't really care what people think, so I just speak the truth. I'm unfiltered. And maybe yeah. I do. Actually, I still do care if people think a little bit. you know, I'm still like insecure on social media. I have to be honest.
Yeah.
I can't imagine being a child on social media. What if you post something, you're a kid, and you only got 6 likes? I'd feel like a loser.
Yeah. Well, that's just the writing of society that you have to change. But it's true. It's like, it's dopamine. It's related to people liking you. And it really has no impact, especially when you think about social media. There's so much information. People don't even realize now that liking anything is that good. Like, I think you just pass through things so fast. But agree, I wouldn't want to be as in tune with like social media as a lot of people. It's not good for you. It adds a lot of stress, adds a lot of anxiety. If you're building something though, if you're building a business or a personal brand, and if you're launching a book and all the stuff that you're doing, there is that balance of, how do you use that to your advantage in an authentic way where you can still do it and not feel that way? Have you been, well, I don't want to go too fast there, because so you get out in 2011, it's still not legal in any state. What do you do? Like, what's your business decision, your life decision? Because all of a sudden you've gone a little bit deep. You've kind of figured out yourself. You've had this second chance in prison. It's 2011 still. It's not that it's legal in state.
Well, I actually was in jail. Wait, so I got out of prison in 2013. That's a whole story. I was in and out of jail. I was rearrested I had to launder money to pay my lawyer. I got arrested a second time because it was like, well, they said I was lying. That's all in the book. But so I get out in 2013 finally.
Okay.
And when I got out, I'm an intelligent guy. So any business I touch is going to work. It's just a matter of if I'm going to be passionate about it. I knew when I was in prison, the next thing I started, I had to be passionate about in order for it to succeed, because I like to work a lot of hours and I don't want to work on something I'm miserable with.
Mm-hmm.
So I weighed all my options. I started creating a social media app. I designed the interface. It was to help you surround yourself with like-minded people, because I thought the social media was really disconnecting. I felt like social media was invented by antisocial people. So I was like, then I'm going to invent, you know, so I was like, I'm going to design something different, but I didn't follow through with that. Anyway, I still have it on the sideburn. I wrote a book. Listen, the book was a long time. That took me 6 years.
Wow. I really want to talk about just like the whole book process.
Six years. Yeah. Yeah. Because I had to be extremely vulnerable for this thing to be a page turner. It's not just about me. It's about the reader. Yeah. So every single page I had to be like, yay, I did this big deal, but what's in it for the reader?
Yes.
So I had to like constantly, it was just like a refining. And it was a lonely time too, because I couldn't, if I'd step out of writing for a day or two, I'd lose my vibe and my flow. So I couldn't like go off and party for 2-3 days and come back. I'd just be a delusional. And I don't party that much anyways anymore. So,
yeah.
But that was a lonely time, but I had some good girlfriends along the way. And I learned a lot from the women I've been with, right? You know, a lot of people, I've never been married or I don't have kids, but I've had a fair amount, a wide variety of girlfriends that have taught me to be who I am. So I've learned a lot of good things from each one. So
yeah.
That's what I did. I went through a few girlfriends. I wrote a book, and then I eventually last year got involved in the New York State cannabis industry.
How was that? Like just making, like, how did you decide to get in the legal industry?
Well, I was introduced through a friend. Somebody approached me. They knew about my book and they just wanted me to be involved and help them, assist them with the cultivation aspect and distribution, just build a brand. But things have been really slow going in New York State so far. Yeah.
It's been so slow. And I talked to a lawyer on the podcast this week about it, actually a former regulator from a different state, just about regulation. And it's interesting to get everyone's perspective, but it seems like it's going very slow. The illicit market is thriving. And for me, as a CPA, like the taxes are ridiculous. Like the taxes are not going to help anybody because it's imposed on milligrams of THC. So as you've been kind of, you're a smart business person, like as you've been kind of looking at the ecosystem in New York, how do you think it's shaping up now, if you want to actually build something successful in that state?
I think the potency tax is really going to prevent, it's going to prevent the legal market from overtaking the illicit market.
Yeah.
Because you're talking, if you have a 20% THC in a flower, it could be around 400 to 500 pounds. No, I'm sorry, $400 to $500 per pound of tax, of potency tax. That's huge.
Yeah.
I can't even make, you can't operate. The margins are going to be so tight that the only people that are going to be able to operate and win in this are the ones that can afford to take a loss for 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, dude. And it's like even the milligrams on edibles are taxed differently than, like, they're the highest tax. And so I ran some numbers. People will be operating at a negative gross profit, like on the product. Like the margins are non-existent. And then you have 280E. So it's just, it's wild. And for me, what's been so frustrating is nobody at the state seems to care. And then I talked to this former regulator. They probably just didn't even understand how to write the regulations in when it comes to taxes. So I completely agree with you. I think that, yeah, I mean, I'm always wondering, like, what's the solution here? Have you been involved in any of those conversations with?
I haven't.
Yeah.
They could lower the potency tax or they could totally get rid of it. I think a happy medium would be to cut it in half.
Yeah, I think so.
You cut it in half and then I don't think the regulators don't understand the industry. That's it. It's the bottom line. And, you know, and when you try to, you know, greediness will really crush this industry. It'll still work though, because it's New York State and there's people that can afford to lose money for 5 years.
Yeah.
And those are the guys that are going to win.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's show. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this, leave us a 5-star review. Make sure that you share this episode on your social media and tag us in the Instagram stories. You can find us wherever you go on social media. Just look up Cannabis Business Minds. Have an idea for the show or something that you want to talk about? Shoot us an email at podcast@cannabisbusinessminds.com.